It doesn't vary so much from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as it does from time period to time period. That is, the older practice was to put the moving party first, and if the plaintiff won below, it was the defendant who was appealing, they would switch it around. That was the older practice. It got way too confusing. So the modern practice, and I don't know exactly when the switchover occurred, maybe about 1950 or so, that it was switched around so that regardless of who won or who lost, the order and the name of the case would remain the same. So, you know, like Rylance versus Fletcher or something like that, they switch them around. But most of the time, sometimes you also have, you know, case names that don't seem terribly reflective. You can't figure out why they named it after this person or that person. But anyway, that's kind of the, as I say, it doesn't vary so much from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as it is the older practice than the modern practice. Yes, ma'am.
Along those same lines, for in-ring things, and you think for how come they didn't put me and then another.
Right. That's a reflection of the peculiar nature of admiralty cases. That is, cases involving maritime activity and the law of the sea. That's always been an odd little body of law because, in part, admiralty cases are often sort of international in flavor and they involve, you know, stuff that's. In fact, as you may know, admiralty is one of the areas that is identified in the Constitution as within the jurisdiction of the federal courts. So, from the founding of the republic, it was recognized that rather than having states deal with cases involving, you know, ship owners and lost cargo and that sort of stuff, it was logical to have the federal courts do it. Now, the reason it's the T.J. Hooper is that one way to begin an admiralty case, and I don't really know much about admiralty, but at least as I understand it, you can begin an admiralty case by doing something called putting a libel on the ship or the vessel. It's like a lien. You know, if you put a lien on something, you're essentially saying, hey, I have a claim to this particular piece of property or this car or whatever it is. And so you could essentially say, I have a claim to this vessel, this ship, because the owner of it messed me over in this thing. You know, so in effect, then it would be, rather than having this person versus that person, it was, well, what about the claims against this particular ship? So you will have, you know, claims that are, in red, T.J. Hooper, rather than United States versus Carroll Towing or Jones versus Smith or something like that. So in admiralty cases become a little sort of world unto their own, historical anomalies, but so it is. Yeah?
In Carroll's going to get the learning aspect. Is there any difference in the test between that and the Levi case or the modifier? Or is the Levi case just to show how it's applied?
Just to show how it's applied. And again, I give you the original, you know, origin of this test in the case itself, but then you get a chance to see it, used more in a more modern context. Yeah, so there aren't different tests. Same test. Yeah.
Way back in the United States, chemical companies.
Sure.
Now, in the railroad case before, it made a difference that the children were in the habit of going to the place.
Yeah.
The workers had seen them, and it seemed like the railroad, what was it called,
the turntable?
Yeah, the turntable. The turntable was able to be seen, and then in the United States, the chemical, the judge said that it couldn't be seen, and it didn't appear the children were in the habit of going there. Now, had children been in the habit of going there?
But I don't think that in the sulfuric acid case that Holmes was saying, unlike the turntable case, the defendant in this case didn't have any reason to think the children were in danger or that this was something unexpected or that they weren't negligent. The way Holmes decides the case is to say that a precondition to overcoming the law of trespassers, in effect, that to get reclassified as something other than a trespasser where we don't have to worry about you, you want to be classified as something other than a trespasser, you've got to show that the condition on the defendant's land operated as a kind of, you know, siren, enchanting, entrancing, alluring thing. And so when he says, gee, the facts in this case don't establish there was anything alluring about this condition that caused the children to trespass, they trespassed long before they ever knew anything about what was on that property, so he thinks. If that's true, says Holmes, then they're just trespassers.
So, if with the question that you were to present to us on exam or something of the effect, or just from my own knowledge, if there was a situation where somebody had land and there was no attractive nuisance, there was no invitation of any sort, but kids were in the habit of going there. Kids had found it before, and kids had been going there a whole bunch somehow.
I think I'd like to postpone the actual specifics of this body of law, attractive nuisance. We actually come back to it in Chapter 8.
Okay.
So that we deal with it again in the context of this whole differentiation of which is actually sort of foreign to us now. We're now living in this wonderful world of, you know, reasonable care, in which that's kind of the coin of the realm. And when we get to Chapter 8, it suddenly turns out that, gee, with respect to landowners, we sort of set this whole business of reasonable care aside and we start talking about people's status on land. And so we have to wrestle with why in the world, you know, what's so different about this that makes our usual reference to reasonable care no longer applicable. So the specifics of handling that in Chapter 8, I want to save, so we'll have the wonderful experience of it then. But the point I was trying to get you to in reading those cases right off the bat was just to see the way in which you could kind of be taken in, as it were, Holmes talking about, you know, children following, you know, things. You can be taken in by this very persuasive opinion by Holmes and think, well, that's the cat's meow. And one of the things I wanted to do was to say, who says a succeeding generation of judges will agree with him? You know, who says your client could rely on Holmes, no matter how persuasive Holmes might be? A later court might decide Holmes was nuts. Or, you know, they have a better way to establish the rules for liability. So again, it was, on the one hand, I can help my client figure out, well, this is what courts have done in the past. It's likely that courts are going to do something similar in the future. But at the end of the day, I don't have the level of certainty, reliability in dealing with what a court will do that I might have if I were practicing medicine and I could say, gee, if you've got this particular infection, this particular drug will, you know, wipe it out. Because I'm not dealing with something that is as controllable or predictable. So, and then again, just with respect to the whole relationship of allurement and all the rest of it, why don't we save our fire on that one until we get to that section of the book. Yeah.
Just a
visual
history question on Ben and Reed.
Yeah.
There was a phrase that led me to believe that the kill and upheld at the upheld level and then the kill again.
Yeah, that came up in class. I don't know if it was in your section, but it did come up, and I can't remember that part of it. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah, you're right. That's exactly the right inference you should draw there, because it is a New York case with the three-tiered system, and in the appellate division is that intermediate. So I think the appellate division essentially patted the trial judge on the head and said, good job. And so again, this court reverses that and says that the plaintiff had no business getting a verdict out of it. Yeah.
Along the same lines as the word, what does that mean? The defendant saved his rights by appropriate exception.
Okay.
That's
Remembering that one of the central principles of appellate procedure is you can't complain about something on appeal unless you've taken that same position at the trial court. So one of the things that you have to do is object, to make a timely objection. So for example, if the plaintiff introduces evidence or offers a witness that the defendant says, hey, this is hearsay or it's, you know, a violation of some evidence rule. If the defendant's going to complain on appeal, that judgment shouldn't stand because the plaintiff obtained that judgment by this horrible evidence that never should have come in. Well, the appellate court's going to say to the defendant, well, did you object to it? You know, did you say why you objected to it? So another way of expressing this idea of objection, another sort of term for that is I take exception to that. So, and I'll sometimes say exceptions noted or something like that. It's essentially the same way of saying I object to that. I think what you're doing is wrong. And again, it will often be the role of the trial judge to rule on things as they go along. The older practice sometimes, I think, required a party to say, it was sort of like saying, I'm playing this game under protest, to say to the trial judge, I object to that testimony, and then when the trial judge says, well, I'm going to overrule your objection and let it in, that they would have to say, I plan to appeal you on that. So that the older practice was you had to kind of alert the trial judge to the fact, again, exceptions were properly noted. So this nobody blindsided anybody and laid weeds and let this bad stuff go on and then later complained about it. All the objections were made up front. It was very transparent.
So some of that, they do it at trial.
Yeah.
In the event that they do go to appeal, that they're on the record of saying, I objected to this.
Right, exactly.
So when they get to appeal, they can never object to a point that they didn't object.
Right.
To
you can never accuse me of not having properly preserved this objection. Now, one of the things that this is a little more technical would be exactly why you objected to it. And sometimes you'll say, objection, Your Honor, overruled. And then you go on, and you never well, I thought you were objecting on this basis. You never made it clear that the basis of your objection was this other thing. And, you know, the question will be, how explicitly did the losing party make their pitch? There's also something, another sort of technical point, what's called an offer of proof. So that if, for example, I say, I want to bring this witness to testify to something or other, and the judge says, no, I don't think that witness is qualified, or for whatever reason, you didn't put them on your witness list, or there's some other reason why the witness isn't allowed to testify. In some cases, you need to make an offer of proof that says, if this witness were allowed to testify, this is what I would have this witness say. So again, you're not left kind of guessing about, well, what impact would it have. Again, that's all sort of technical stuff that you get to in evidence or appellate procedure. Yes?
You're on the example of
the
question that are on the TV.
Yeah.
Where should we start studying?
Oh, okay. The way the questions are laid out, they go sequentially, you know, from the oldest to the newest. And the first exam that you have on October 6th or whatever it is the mini exam. So in each year, the first exam is always the mini exam. So you get the exam and the answer. Then you get the midterm, then you get the final, then you start another year. And they're also arranged so that I think the summer sessions come before the summer 2002 will come before the academic year 2002-2003, which we just finished. And then we've actually got the summer 2003, which I think is in there as well. But anyway, you've got, 17 or 18 years worth of, or, 17 or 18 sessions or complete courses. Occasionally I'm missing an exam for one reason or another or an answer, but it's relatively complete. So what I would do, you have so many of them that it's not as though, well, I'm going to use them up and then won't have any more to test myself with. Go ahead and I just read a couple just to get a sense, okay, this is the kind of thing on October 6th, I'm going to be able to, I need to be able to answer. Okay, and here's what he calls, a sample answer. This is the kind of answer I should be prepared to give to this kind of question. And, you know, it might take 10 minutes to read through it and read through the answer. And then you read another question, another answer, read a third question and a third answer. And, now I'm beginning to get the pattern of these mini-exams. And then you get closer, and then it also helps just to calibrate, you know, as you go along, this is the level of detail I need to be able to recite. This is kind of the style or the voice or the, you know, it's, lawyers tend to be very addicted to form books. You know, if I need to do something, you know, write an appellate brief or write a complaint or write a petition or write an answer or whatever, the first thing I want to do is give me one of those, you know, in another case, so that I can just kind of look at the pattern of it, see the sort of shell, the form of it, and then I can begin to plug in the substance accordingly. So in a similar way, just by looking at kind of the form of these questions and how they appear and the kind of answer that seems to be called for, it helps give you a sense, oh, I could do that. At least I hope that's your response. But then as you get closer to it, I would actually give yourself the exam. I mean, take one that you've never seen before and just, you know, give yourself an hour or 55 minutes or whatever it is that we're going to have on Monday, the 6th, and set the clock and try to answer it to see how well you're doing just in terms of timing, because part of exam taking in law school is a timing issue. I don't want to go in too much depth and run out of time. I don't want to be so obsessed with time that I skip over something and finish what I have to say halfway through. I want to set the level of depth so that I finish the thing in about 85% of the time available, and I have the last 15% in case I've misjudged something and I need to go back and fix something or go back and proofread it or reread the question, make sure I didn't miss something. But just adapting, figuring out the time management part of it will really help give you a better feel for it if you need to make an adjustment. I'm going way too fast, I've got to slow down, or I'm going way too slow and I've got to, you know, move at a more rapid pace. It also, when you give yourself an exam like that, it really boosts your courage or your confidence. So that instead of walking into the exam feeling like, gee, I'm about to, you know, I'm going into this dark tunnel and I don't know what's on the other side of it, you walk in the exam room feeling like, you know, I've already done three of these. And yeah, I'm sure it's going to be a little bit different, slightly different facts and a little tweak here and a little tweak there, but I'm basically feeling like I've done this before. So just that, aside from what you learn from having done it, and you get the additional advantage of not having your mind race over and over again, you know, with all the failure scenarios that you start to think about when you're in the midst of a stressful situation. So that I think you can hardly do anything more useful to your exam performance than look at prior exams in every class you have. And I give you all these years worth because I've got them and they're easy for me to give them to you. Other classes that you have may or may not have past years worth of exams from that instructor, but you'll have other exams you know, that the tutor will have or otherwise, and just in each class taking exams and then looking at your performance with a critical eye, even finding, you know, somebody that you in your study group or otherwise that you can swap, you know, agree that you're gonna do this on a, you know, Thursday afternoon, take this hour exam and then trade papers, and then if each of you reads the other one's answer and provides some feedback. It's a really good way to, again, boost your confidence and learn something in the process. So, yeah. Okay, and here's the kind of rule, and I'm just sort of not exactly reciting it from my outline here, but it probably wouldn't be too far from it. That industry custom offers persuasive evidence of what a reasonably prudent person would do, but courts and juries have the freedom to establish a higher standard of care if the industry has fallen below what a reasonably prudent person would do. That's a little capsule summary of what we've been through. Now, before you take the mini exam, I'll give you my own condensed outline. And before you take the midterm in December, you'll get a longer, it's about 6 or 7 pages, which summarizes, double-spaced with, you know, headings and so forth, 5 or 6 pages, which is essentially everything we've learned in the semester. Well, no, it's not everything we've learned in the semester, but it tries to comprehensively describe sort of the in a concise way, just as I did in that little boiled down summary. And one hand, when I hand that out to people, it's kind of a depressing experience because, you know, thinking of how much tuition money has gone into, you know, as Peggy Lee would say, is that all there is? And of course, I hope that isn't all there is, that you've learned a lot more than is reflected in these five or six pages. And when we spent, whatever it was, 40 minutes this morning doing Bennett and T.J. Hooper, we got more out of it than the, you know, 42 words that I just gave you. But it's helpful to at least have that as the summary that reminds you of a more complex body of knowledge. But what's significant about boiling it down to that level is, first of all, it gives you something that's a little bit more, it's required you to kind of toss out the extraneous stuff and get down to the essence of it. The other thing is that you're getting it to the point where you can hand it on to a client. And remember that the assignment on the exam is to analyze the problem for your client and give them some advice. So to the extent that you can take a relatively complex area of the law and express it in the form of, well, it, in its essence, this is what we're talking about. Now, how that applies to you is the following. Well, that allows you to get further with your client in terms of connecting the dots and saying, because the legal rule is this, and because as I see it, the facts either meet or don't meet this legal standard, it leads me to this conclusion. So, for example, if I had a case in which the industry custom favored the defendant, I would say, well, here's the rule, as I just gave it to you. According to that rule, the jury would be vulnerable to persuasion. They're entitled to be persuaded by industry custom. The defendant has, you know, the right to use that in their favor. Of course, we, in theory, can ask the jury, in effect, to overrule that or reject that and substitute their perceived standard of reasonable care. But I have to tell you, you know, from the plaintiff, I'm representing the plaintiff, this being the rule, industry custom is going to favor the defendant. So, again, you want to be able to take the legal rule, apply it. Well, where does that leave us? And again, as I suggested before, I try to use the analogy to medical care because most of us have had more experience going to a doctor getting medical advice than we have going to a lawyer and getting legal advice. So, you know, when I use the medical analogy, I'm trying to sort of connect with something that sounds more familiar. And when you go to the doctor and you've got something like your knee's kind of stiff and painful, and you're trying to figure out, well, what can I do about this? You need to know enough about the medical condition so that then your options, surgery, medication, exercise, ignore it, you know, what would you recommend as far as dealing with this bum knee that I have? Again, the doctor needs to give you enough medical knowledge so that then the advice makes sense. And in a similar way, you want to give your client enough legal knowledge so that then the options of saying, looking good over here, not looking so good over there, overall I'd say we're in good shape, we're in tough shape, you know, when we get down to making decisions, do we try to settle this case, do we hang on and go to trial? So again, getting it boiled down to that point is good not only for understandings, but it may be the currency with which I later write my exam. Yeah?
I'm having difficulty understanding to what extent the court takes in statutory law. For example, in Hammond Street, it appears to me that the defendant following the letter of the law. He was going to the DMV every year.
Okay.
Doing what they said. And then, in the case for today, Hooper, it appears that he was following the law by having just a transit set and not one for a seat.
Right. Right. Now, in some ways, this borrows what we're going to do tomorrow with Martin versus Herzog, and I generally want to save all the fun for class, but I think I can do this without spoiling anything, and that is to say that compliance with the statute doesn't really do the defendant a whole lot of good. That is, if I'm alleged to have been negligent in driving my car, for example, and I say, well, my car was in great mechanical shape, you know, my brakes were working fine. I mean, I can go through a long list. I wasn't speeding. I was sober. So I can go through a long list of things that I did in compliance with the law, and that doesn't really answer the question, yeah, but you still could have been negligent in three other ways, even though you obeyed the statute over here. The other thing is that with respect to tort law, statutes typically don't cover much of the material of abiding by the standard of care. That is, they may tell me to do this, this, and this, and avoid that, but in terms of what decisions I make, what safety precautions I take, they will often be a function of such things as industry custom, or, you know, safety policies that I've adopted, or other, you know, indications of what would be a smart thing to do. So statutes, in effect, can hurt the defendant, but statutes rarely help the defendant. I think I make one reference at some point around this area to preemption. There are certain areas like this, like the tobacco cases, at least the older ones, where there was a statute that took over and said, in place of all of these sorts of, you know, case law and tradition and this, that, and the other thing, here is the standard, and if you follow this standard, you can't be whacked for something else. That was the fruit of the, you know, political compromise over cigarette warning labels and that sort of thing. But that's pretty rare. The preemption of state tort law by some mandatory federal system is pretty rare. Most of the time, the defendant only, you know, benefits, or the defendant's only hurt by it. Statutes only have the effect of making their life miserable. The defendant typically would be better off if there were no statutes. And it's the plaintiff who wants to use them against the defendant. Yeah? Yeah, particularly when it comes to dealing with their own safety. So that if, for example, Mr. Menlove, instead of being the defendant, were the plaintiff, and he got hurt, and he alleged it was due to the defendant's negligence, and the defendant turned around, as they do in Martin versus Herzog, and say, yeah, but you were stupid, you didn't look out for your own safety, then in many cases like that, the plaintiff can say, but look, you know, I was mentally handicapped, or I was, you know, blind, or whatever else, and the court will say, okay, in terms of, not in terms of putting other people at risk, but in terms of your own safety, we will take into account the limitations you have. So, yeah, in that case it does. Right. I'm not entirely sure. I think I think they were saying with respect to this particular well, it was negligent for them to leave the wires the way they were. But I think as they figured out, and they didn't actually give us numbers, you know, they didn't say the probability is 0.00 such and so. But as they're looking at the probability, they're using the experience, in effect, of lots of different wells and lots of different, you know, wiring systems. So rather than being able to make predictions about this particular well, you often judge probability by a more general experience of saying, over the lifetime of people servicing oil wells with rigs like this, the probability of somebody encountering a high voltage line is such and so. So in that respect, although they're making a judgment about this particular well, let's say, for example, the well was only, it was some peculiar kind of well, and it only got visited every other year or something like that. Then you would say, gee, the probability that if it's only visited once every other year, the probability that somebody's going to get hurt is pretty small. I wouldn't throw a whole lot of money, you know, rearranging the wires if we're talking about a very low probability. So I think in one sense, they are looking at this specific case, but as they try to make the comparison, how much is the burden relative to the probability of harm, the magnitude of harm, they're drawing on more general experience with oil wells. Generally, same way with respect to the injury, the L in is B less than B times L. In this particular case, he was grievously injured. But the question they would ask is, what's the average kind of injury we could expect? In the same way, in the Pinto case, when you're looking at what's the average severity of a rear-end collision triggering fire. Again, it happens in this particular case, the guy was very badly burned, but it also is true that his injury is fairly typical. So when you're calculating is B less than P times L, you're tending to generalize over a sort of idealized set of circumstances like this, because that's what the defendant's going to be dealing with. The defendant doesn't know it's this particular well that's going to be a problem, that this particular guy is going to be burned in this particular way. What you're asking is, would a reasonable person looking at that, recognizing its similarity to other cases where similar things are likely to happen, would a reasonable person recognize the value of, oh, gee, that's too dangerous, let's reroute those electric lines? Or would a reasonable person say, well, you know, under the circumstances, it's really not so bad? So again, that's what makes applying the learned hand formula so difficult. You rarely see people actually plugging numbers into it, because there are usually so many variations in the circumstances that you could play with the numbers all day long. It's more an aid to a thinking process than it is something like a spreadsheet where you're figuring out, if I buy this much house with this big a down payment and the interest rates are this, how much will my monthly mortgage payment be? It's not that kind of a spreadsheet formula. It's more just sort of a thinking process.
So would the burden be generalized like that, as well as how much would it cost the company to do the whole thing just at that one particular?
Well, again, if you go back to United States versus Carroll Towing, how much would it cost in general? I have no way of knowing on this particular night I'm going to need a bargee. So the question is, how much is it going to cost me to have a bargee on board, in effect, all the time, generally? So, yeah, there again, you've got to do this more sort of abstract consideration of, since I won't know in advance which of these things is going to trigger the need for the safety device, I've got to have it on, in effect, all the time, then that's the burden that I have to undergo. Like Ford, you know, they couldn't select out the cars that were going to be in rear-end collisions. If they're going to prevent this particular kind of harm, they had to install this liner in the gas tank on every car they sold. That's why the precaution, in their eyes, was more expensive than it was worth. Going once. Good. I'll see you tomorrow morning.